I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It was a steamy summer evening in one of the smartest suburbs of Cairo. Saad Eddin Ibrahim was working late in his study, deeply immersed in his reading, or maybe he just dozed off. He was snapped sharply awake by a fierce pounding on the door. The aggressive visitors were dozens of armed guards, Egypt's fearsome SSI, state security investigators. The 61-year-old professor, top Egyptian-American social scientist and leading Arab advocate of civil rights, was under arrest. There were no shortage of reasons. Were Egypt a classic oppressive Arab regime? He'd criticized rigged elections and commented on Republican dynasties with President Mubarak in mind. But he was a friend of the president's wife and had friends in high places in the United States, too. But he was jailed for 2 years, surviving atrocious conditions, deteriorating health, and farcical trials. The U.S. protested, and President Bush blocked aid to Egypt in protest. So Professor Ibrahim is free and fearless. 3 years to the day after his arrest, he reopened his center in Cairo, promoting democracy throughout the Arab world, a roadmap for every nation, starting with Iraq. He's here in the U.S. picking up a prestigious honor in Atlanta from the American Sociological Association for his service to social science and free speech. Saad Eddin Ibrahim sees a future for human rights in the Middle East, but it may mean a serious bit of regime change and some outreach to Islamic militants. Connection listeners, do you share his vision for shaking things up? How about his optimism? And do you think that, as he does, that the U.S. should stop accommodating hereditary republics like those in Egypt and Jordan and start demanding more democracy? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Saad Eddin Ibrahim and his wife Barbara join us now. They met in the turbulent 60s when he was a tutor and she a student at DePauw University. From there, it was Beirut, Baghdad and Cairo, together gathering insights into the ills and misconceptions of the Arab world and what the U.S. could do to help things. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Nice to talk to you both. Professor Ibrahim, can we take you back to that night on June 30th? As I said, you were there in your study, reading or dozing. What happened?
Well, as you just described, about midnight, I heard this heavy pounding on the door. I thought my son forgot his key. It was a weekend in Cairo. So slowly I got up from my desk and opened the door to found this crowd of armed guards. They stormed the house and began to search it. And to at the end of an hour of search, they took me out, and only to discover there is more armed guards outside, probably about 200 of them in armored cars, enough to invade a small town. So I was not only stunned, but I also was baffled by why all this force to arrest one aging professor in the middle of the night.
Oh, you had poked your stick into a few wasps' nests, though, hadn't you? I mean, you defended the Islamic militants for a start by your stance on the Copt Christians, but also talking about rigged elections, talking about Republican dynasties, touchy subjects in Egypt.
Well, yes, but I did all of that peacefully without using any browsing language or let alone using any arms or violence. And I thought, as an intellectual, as a professor, as a political sociologist, I was doing my country and my nation a service. And if others saw it otherwise, I thought it would be their problem, not my problem.
Barbara, can I ask you, do you think your husband is slightly naive? Because you were American-born, you've lived here, you've then traveled, to, as I said, through many countries in the Middle East and ended up in Egypt. Do you think his attitude to how free things are and how free his speech might be is a tad naive?
I guess the answer to that now is yes. But in the year 2000, we shared an optimism about Egypt and about other countries in the region. Clearly, there's a struggle going on within leadership in many of the Arab regimes about moving forward, opening to the rest of the world, leaving behind repressive measures. But those forces are in continual conflict. And in the year 2000, the security forces were in the ascendancy.
Saad Ibrahim, do you have any idea why at that point you were arrested? Because you were actually sent to the jail that usually houses Islamic militants. They never sent a liberal there. I mean, there have been action taken against liberals in Egypt, but never anything on this scale. What was it? What was it about that particular time? Do you know?
Well, naive or idealistic, I don't know, but obviously by that time, I had alienated many powerful centers of power in Egypt, and the last of which, obviously, was the presidency itself. And that seemed to have been the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, because it is that day that my article about Republican dynasties appeared in a London-based magazine called El Mujalla. And when it arrived on the newsstands the morning of June 30th, it was that night that I was arrested. And I suppose, even though I don't have any firm evidence, I suppose that probably was the final straw that broke the camel back.
But because Republican dynasties, as you refer to them, I mean, we tend to think of the Assads and the Saddam Husseins and his sons, who were no friends of the United States. And they could be painted as villains. But, of course, alluding to the same sort of system in Egypt, the real pal of the United States, might have seemed very offensive. But what was the actual charge?
Well, actually, that particular issue never appeared in the official charges. The official charges had to do, as you said in the introduction to this program, of vilifying and undermining and defaming the state, accepting money from the European Union to do my election registration drive without state authorization, without government approval, and basically defrauding the European Union out of its money. These were the official charges. What I mentioned about the Republican dynasty, everybody suspected was the real reason, but it was not officially, I was not officially charged by this one. So anyhow, in the trial, every time the lawyers tried to bring that issue up, the court and the prosecutor shut them up and prevent them from talking about it until we came to the Court of Cassation 2.5 years later, where we could say anything and everything my defense could marshal to get me acquitted was said, including this one. Go ahead. No, it's all right.
Tell me what conditions were like in jail.
Well, I was in and out three times. And the conditions were not pleasant, as you would expect. Prison is a prison, a loss of freedom. But the first imprisonment term, which was 45 days, was by far the toughest, the roughest, and the most, shall we say, painful to me. Not only because it was the first time I spent that much time in jail, but because I was in solitary confinement. And this is, as criminologists know, this is the toughest punishment any human being as a social animal could be subjected to, is to be insulated completely from other human beings. The second and third were more bearable. I was already convicted, and as a convict, I had certain minimum rights which were observed by the prison authorities, and therefore it wasn't as bad, even though I was still confined, insulated from other prisoners. Others were not supposed to talk to me or communicate with me. However, the informal system in prison allowed me to be in touch with others behind the backs of the authorities in prison.
Barbara, tell us about the campaign here in the United States to free your husband. I mean, you could almost say that he's lucky in that he's a liberal with connections in the West, been taught at many a university, has an American wife, an Egyptian-American. Tell us about getting the campaign going here.
We were fortunate on many grounds. This is, in some ways, a campaign that the Internet created and certainly couldn't have happened 6 or 8 years ago. Within hours of understanding that Saad was going to be detained, we had contacted friends here in the U.S., actually some family members, who began pulling together and culling media email addresses and telephone numbers. We set up a website with my son's help very soon afterwards. And the fact that Saad had selflessly given interviews to these journalists and others over the years when they made visits to Cairo meant that they remembered him, remembered that when they needed a story, he'd been the person who was willing to speak frankly. And so they were outraged at what was happening to him. And I must say that outside of Egypt and outside of the Arab world, it was not a difficult campaign to mobilize. Our difficulties were inside the country, where we had no access to the media, where state-controlled newspapers and television were on a daily basis disparaging Saad, his career, calling him everything from a traitor to a despot, to an embezzler of the funds at his center. And we had a very hard time getting space publicly in Egypt.
Do you think the clincher to secure Saad's release was President Bush's act when he said he was withholding $130 million in aid? I was wondering actually how you got him on board, but was that the clincher?
That moment both made things more difficult for us and probably moved forward the process of resolution. I say it made things more difficult because one of the things that Saad's enemies have tried to do for many years is associate him as an agent of Western powers, and especially of the most disliked superpower. So the Bush intervention, because it was made so publicly, enabled those forces to say, aha, here's the CIA and the United States rescuing their agent. On the other hand, Saad's case was already on its way to be put before the highest court in the land, a court which we knew to be independent and which we had great faith would eventually acquit him. And I think that the Bush statement pushed forward that process, helped elements within the Egyptian government realize that the damage had now become so great that they needed to quickly move toward resolution.
Connection listeners, as you can hear, we're talking to Professor Saad Ibrahim and Barbara this hour. So do you share their vision for shaking things up in the Middle East? Do you share the professor's optimism? And do you think, as he does, that the U.S. should stop accommodating hereditary republics like those in Egypt and Jordan and demand more democracy? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking to Professor Saad Ibrahim and his wife, Barbara, this hour and asking the question, can democracy continue to be denied in the Middle East? 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Professor Ibrahim, we said in the opening you might expect you to be the most pessimistic man in the Middle East. You seem like the most optimistic because you're saying things can be changed, and you're using that wonderful term, roadmap. They need a roadmap for each country. Huge subject, but can you encapsulate what you're actually saying?
Well, basically, as an activist, I believe in change. I believe that change could come about. Otherwise, I wouldn't be an activist. And I think the whole world has been going through a democratization process. The only lagging region behind is the Arab world. And I am determined to be part of those forces that will push the process into the Arab world as well. And may I just interrupt and say a correction? Jordan is not a hereditary republic. Jordan is a monarchy. The hereditary republics that I refer to in my writing included Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and Egypt. This is just a correction. And I believe that some of these republics could also become constitutional monarchies. And therefore, everybody has to benefit from democracy.
Interesting. You believe constitutional monarchies are a better solution?
Well, yes, of course. In Morocco, in Jordan, in Bahrain, and hopefully very soon in Qatar and in Oman, these are moving in that direction. The last one to do so would be Saudi Arabia, and that will take a bit more work to move it in that direction. But constitutional monarchies, so long as they have an elected government that's accountable, of course, far better than what we have in the Arab world today.
What would you say to the great threat of Islamic militancy in elections if you introduce democracy in the Middle East? Because certainly in Algeria, we saw that when there was free and open elections, it was the Islamic groups that were about to take power.
They were about to take power, but that is their right. If they win in the ballot box, they should be entitled to take over power so long as they respect the rules of the game and they hold the elections regularly. And we have seen examples of that happening in Turkey. An Islamic party called the Development and Justice Party won a plurality and was able to form a government, and it was not the end of the world. The same thing happened in Jordan, in Bahrain, in Kuwait. A majority of seats in some of the recent parliaments were gained by Islamists, and it was not the end of the world. So there are Islamists who are committed to democracy and very much like the Christian Democrats in Western Europe. You have several countries in Western Europe that have Christian Democratic parties who occasionally rule, like in Germany, in Italy, and elsewhere. So we should not be scared of the Islamists taking part in the process, so long as they respect the rules of the game. The ones who are more militant, more violent, have no use for democracy or for elections anyhow, and they will not participate. So I wanted the record to be clear on that. I stand ideologically and intellectually against them, but I think as citizens, they are entitled to the same right. If I am a Democrat, I have to be consistent, and I should not engage in double standards.
1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. Richard is joining us from Shelbyville in Tennessee. Hi, Richard. What's your point?
First of all, I'd like to welcome Professor Ibrahim back. Thank God he's released. And my question is this. Doctor, without a capitalistic base, and it has to be more than just one commodity like oil, it has to be diverse enough. How can you have a democracy without that capitalistic base and reconcile it with Islam?
So you're saying, Richard, are you that you don't believe that democracy and Islam can exist side by side?
Not unless there's a capitalistic base. Marx proved that against his philosophy with Hegel. You have to have a capitalistic base in order to have anything rise up from that. You have to have some kind of a commodity pluralized to keep the people employed gainfully and where they would have the economic power before you can even think of a democracy.
Richard, I'll put that point straight to the professor, but not your dog's comments there. Professor, what do you say that you have to, if you like, get a capitalist-based economy before you can introduce democracy?
Well, I agree with the spirit of Richard's comments in so far as democracy can work better if you have a developed economy that can provide the basic needs, including jobs, to the majority of the people. And we have seen democracy working in countries that are market economy oriented, like most of the Western democracies, actually, and like the Scandinavians, who have had some kind of a social democracy, where you have a regulated market economy and a welfare state. So there is a variety, but the point, I think, is well taken, that in order to have a sustainable democracy, you have to have a certain level of economic development and a continuous prosperity that will provide or will ensure jobs and basic needs for the majority of population.
But what about this question about democracy existing side by side with Islam? I mean, how do you, for a start, pick off the militant Islams from the moderates you were talking about? And can they exist? I mean, think of the example of Iran.
Of course they can, Judy. They can. They can. You have two of the largest countries in the world, Muslim countries in the world, Indonesia and Bangladesh. People forget that. And these are countries that the majority are Muslims, yet they have elected governments, and they have a woman at the head of a state. Many people just overlook this. So we had Pakistan before that, where you have Benazir Bhutto as a prime minister. You had Turkey. So many of the stereotypes that people hold about Muslim countries or about Islam and its consistency with democracy or its hospitality to democracy or to capitalism are to be tested empirically. And the tests so far have shown that there is no contradiction whatsoever. You could have Islam, capitalism, and democracy. And as I said, the biggest Muslim countries have all three.
Barbara, this is a question you must get asked a lot, having been brought up in America and then going to the Middle East. How do you answer it? You know, it could work, but it doesn't in the Middle East.
Well, I find that offensive because religion is a belief system. And if you look back into history, there were times in which theorists said that Catholic countries could never be hospitable to democracy. And we've since learned that that's ridiculous. And I think we're at that kind of a historical moment where people's fear of a politicized minority of individuals who are using Islam, abusing Islam for their political purposes as militants, has caused everyone to be afraid of a faith that has, you know, been peacefully propagated for millennia.
Professor, let's flip that question on its head. Do you think this, in quotes, perceived threat of militant Islam is helping to keep the hereditary dynasties, the hereditary Republican dynasties and monarchies in power throughout the Middle East? That they say, look at the alternative, and that's a very useful threat. To keep the Fars in power in Saudi Arabia, to keep Mubarak in power, to keep Assad in power?
Well, Judy, I think you put your hand on it. This fear-arousing approach, which many governments in the West, even media people like yourself, have swallowed, is that if you allow democracy in these countries, Islamists will take over. It will be a Khomeini-like style or Algerian-like style situation. This is not the case. And I keep bringing about Indonesia, Bangladesh, Turkey, Bahrain, and people refuse to look at it. And they continue to be victims of that fear-arousing approach, which autocratic regimes in the Middle East have successfully been able to internalize in the minds of decision makers in Western democracies, which is an irony because, you know, here you have independent media, you have scholars, you have research centers who could have checked these things, who could have said exactly what I'm saying. And I wouldn't have been working for democratizing the Middle East if I had sensed that democracy will bring about the kind of doomsday that the regimes seem to be propagating. No, of course not.
800-423-8255 to join the conversation. Alberta's joining us from Needham, Mass. Alberta, hi, your point.
Thank you very much for taking my call. And I think I appreciate Professor Ibrahim's contribution. His comments lead me to believe that the reason that autocratic governments in the Middle East, such as Syria and Saudi Arabia and Egypt, do not want to see the formation of a Palestinian state in spite of their protestations, because they know that a Palestinian state would have a more democratic structure, and therefore it may infect their own countries.
Professor, do you agree with that? Palestine's used as that there is a fear of a democratic Palestine.
Yes, there is a fear of any democracy in the Arab world, because that would mean a demonstration effect. And, of course, Palestinians having elected their own government back in 1996 stands as an example that despite all the calamities that befell the Palestinians, yet at the first chance that they could express their political will, they did so freely and in a democratic way. That stands as a threat to all the autocracies in the Middle East.
Alberto, do you think the same applies to Iraq, that the neighbors of Iraq, including Egypt and Jordan, would rather not see democracy on their doorsteps? Thank you.
I agree, but that's not my opinion. I think the government, our government in the United States itself, has expressed that opinion.
Professor, would you agree with that?
I'm not sure exactly what is the point, but yes, there is a fear of a democratic Iraq as well. And there is almost a wish on the part of all the autocratic regimes that the U.S. will fail in its quest to democratize Iraq. Of course, the U.S. has not done everything right since the invasion, but nevertheless, the noble objective of allowing the Iraqis to evolve their own democratic governance has to be commended and has to be encouraged and has to be reinforced. And I hope there will be sustainability in this drive.
Do you think there will be a domino effect, that Iraq will be first and it could spread, well, perhaps to Jordan or maybe Egypt first? Or do you think that the closer they get to democracy, the neighbors will start trying to undermine things in Iraq? Maybe it's even going on now.
Well, that's probably true. A democracy in Iraq will definitely have a very direct impact on Syria and will push Iran also in the same direction. Because in the literature and in the experience of democratization the last 30 years, there is what we call a democratic neighborhood. If you have your neighbors as democratic, it helps to move countries that are not yet democratic in that direction. So, yes, a domino effect will be at work if Iraq becomes a democracy.
Do you believe that the U.S. really, the Bush administration really wants a democratized Middle East, though? I mean, if we take your own country, President Mubarak, isn't it handier to have the Fahds and the Mubaraks and the Abdullahs in power, autocrats you can do business with, rather than the messiness of democracy?
Well, I have to take the American administration on its own word. And as a democracy advocate, I will welcome anyone who announces, who declares, who shows signs of meeting my agenda. I am not into the business of inquisition to know whether they are sincere in their hearts. No, what matters to me is actual behavior. The fact that there is work underway to draft a constitution, there is a provisional council, ruling council, there is a date and agenda to bring about democracy. All of this suggests that there is seriousness in the American attempt to democratize. But as I said, I'm not in the business of going beyond actual behavior, including written and spoken statements by the President of the United States, by the Foreign Secretary or the Secretary of State, and by other officials. Of course, time will tell, and we as Democrats are going to keep the pressure on the United States as we keep the pressure on our own governments to move into the democratic scheme.
Do you think that what is going on now in Iraq is heartening, that people, ordinary Iraqis, are beginning to get a taste of freedom and understand it, and that gradually it is becoming a democratic country? Or are you concerned about what's happening there, that various groups are taking advantage of this transition period?
Well, you know, if you go around the world to see countries that have moved from non-democratic to democratic rule, there was always a period of confusion, period of anarchy, period of opportunism by different forces. But if the drive to democratize is sustained by whoever is leading it, then these things will fall in place. And that took us to the first comment by Richard, who called, about development and about the level of stability, level of economic prosperity, or at least some minimum basic needs satisfaction, provision of basic needs. And what we have in Iraq nowadays, from all the accounts, is a failure to get the utilities and the services underway and to provide people with jobs and incomes.
Professor Saad Ibrahim, democracy campaigner from Egypt, is our guest this hour with his wife Barbara. Our question: can democracy in the Middle East continue to be denied? Must the U.S. give a nudge to its friends in the region as well as its enemies? 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. My guest this hour, Professor Saad Ibrahim, and his wife, Barbara, democracy campaigner in Egypt, who paid for his views with a couple of years in jail. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to talk to the professor. Sam joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. My question actually relates to a comment that Mr. Ibrahim made about a certain few countries such as Bahrain and Qatar and all these moving towards democracies. But in fact, if you look at the way their elections took place, it seemed as if the people would elect 10 people and then 10 other people would be handpicked by the monarch to balance this. So in fact, they're lying to the people and to the rest of us, just so that pressure is taken off them. So do we have a different definition of democracy in the Middle East?
Professor, do we have a different definition of democracy in the Middle East?
No, democracy is democracy. It implies people's choice. And Sam has a good point in the sense that some of these countries, like Bahrain, has moved recently to democracy, with one council elected and another council appointed. This is not unusual in some democracies, including Western democracy like the United Kingdom, where you have the House of Commons and you have the House of Lords. So whether we approve of it or not, but there is definitely a more democracy in a country like Bahrain this day than there was 2 years ago.
Then do you think it is a sort of slow incremental process? Because take your own country. President Mubarak is there and he's re-elected with 99.9% of the vote as the only candidate at subsequent elections. There is a parliament, but it's very much seen as a rubber stamp parliament. And probably the most popular party would be the Muslim Brotherhood if they could actually stand as a party, but they can't. I mean, how close is that to democracy?
So are you asking about Egypt or about Bahrain?
Egypt.
Egypt. No, no, we're far away from democracy, what I'm fighting for. If I can have what Bahrain has, I will be half as happy. And of course, I'll be fully happy if we have a fully democratic parliament, fairly and honestly. But I am willing to go gradual about it. I'm willing to be incremental about it, so long as it's a steady incrementation. That's what we don't have in Egypt. As a matter of fact, things are deteriorating. Every time we have an election, it is worse than the election before in terms of irregularity, in terms of fraud, in terms of government cheating, and so on. So what we are fighting for is not an overnight change to make our system like a Westminster democracy or like, you know, Scandinavian democracy, but to move in that direction and with no illusion that it will take some time. What I'm fighting for is to get the process underway clearly, transparently, and accurately.
Barbara, do you think there is a basic misunderstanding of the Arab world, in the U.S. as a whole, but in the administration as well? They don't understand Arab feelings and aspirations. They tend to caricature the Arab world.
No question about it. If you think about American cinema, political cartoons, the Arabs remain the one ethnic group that it's still acceptable to slur, to stereotype, to denigrate officially. On the other hand, I know that people who have visited the Arab world come back with those stereotypes challenged and replaced by an admiration, an interest, an appreciation of the culture. So part of the problem is the remainder of these stereotypes in textbooks, in political movements, and certain interest groups in the United States who really probably fear that if the Arab world is completely understood, it might tip the balance of the Arab-Israeli conflict away from the favor of Israel. So there are a lot of political as well as cultural reasons why I think the stereotypes persist.
Do you have an answer as an outsider going to the region as to why things keep on going wrong for the Middle East? 10% of the world's population had 30% of the wars. Eisenhower called it the most expensive piece of real estate on earth. And yet when you went there in the 70s to Lebanon, Beirut must have been, it was a sort of Europeanized town, wasn't it? It was a real heyday for Lebanon. It was a wonderful place in the Middle East. And then it just went dramatically wrong and had one of the bloodiest civil wars. Do you have an answer to that, Barbara?
You're absolutely right that those were heydays of great promise for countries like Lebanon. But unfortunately, Lebanon was not left to resolve its own issues. It has ethnic problems. There was a sense that some groups had been excluded from power. But when the civil war broke out, it was exacerbated by the presence of huge numbers of Palestinian refugees whose own issues of a homeland had not been resolved. Syrians and others became actively engaged in that civil war, and the Lebanese have never been allowed to resolve their own problems. And this is the tragedy that repeats itself over and over again in the Arab world. It's unfortunately got a lot of oil under the sand. It's politically and geographically strategic, and so its problems, which are real and which need to be addressed, are always overlaid with other issues and other interests. And this is a great and a continuing tragedy.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Saeed is joining us from Pembroke Pines in Florida. Hi, Saeed.
Hi. Forgive me for not knowing the names of the panel there. I just have a couple of points. I was born in Lebanon, and over the years I have noticed in my childhood that our people in power within the structure of the Arab world have been put by either American or British government somewhere or another. And where was democracy when bin Laden was put in power in Afghanistan and the mullahs? Where was democracy when Saddam Hussein was put in power? And is Saudi Arabia and Egypt next on the list to be destroyed like Iraq is being today? I mean, where is this going to stop? And when do we choose, as the U.S. government does, democracy today, but no, let's wait. When we don't need them anymore, then we'll choose democracy then.
Well, right, Professor Ibrahim, Said is making more or less the point Barbara is, that outside forces, Britain and the United States, intervene and leave a bigger mess behind than when they arrived, really. I mean, is intervention called for, or is benign neglect called for, apart from Iraq?
Well, you know, the court situation is far more complex than to give a simple answer to that. But it's true that in the past, Western powers got involved in the Middle East to fulfill their own designs, not the interests of the people or the countries of the region. And they may still continue to do it. The only guard against it is public opinion in their own, in these own Western countries that should keep a vigilance and keep watching what their governments are doing, and also the indigenous forces in the Arab world and the Middle East. And that's what democracy is all about, is to make people make their own choice, choose their own government, decide their own foreign policy, their own foreign alliances, and their supporters all over the world.
Well, that's the idealistic vision, but where does the U.S. put the pressure if it does? You singled out Bahrain as somewhere where democracy is taking root. For 30 years, Bahrain didn't dare have a parliament because of giant Saudi Arabia looking over its shoulder. Has some pressure been brought to bear there by the United States to tell Saudi Arabia to lay off?
Well, Judy, you have two or three things working in the case of Bahrain and others. One is the first Gulf War, 1990-91. That was one of the forces that created fluidity in the region that made some countries move in that direction, like Qatar, like Oman, like the United Arab Emirates, and so on. Bahrain also had a very strong opposition that has been rousing all kind of trouble for the absolute monarchy that prevailed and prevented a democratic parliament from being elected. Finally, all of these things seem to have converged. And with the invasion of Iraq, it expedited the process. The presence of America in the region sometimes has this positive effect and, of course, has also a negative effect.
Said, can I just bring you in briefly and say what you think the U.S. should do? Obviously, you think they've got it wrong in the past, back the wrong people. Said, so what do you think?
I think they should reach out to indigenous democratic forces, give them all the support they can.
Sorry, Said. You both called Said. Let's hear Said from Pembroke Pines and then come back Professor Ibrahim.
Okay, go ahead.
Said.
Right. That's okay. Yeah, briefly, I would say that the U.S. government really, really intentionally should look into this culture, should look into the needs of the average people. For people that are suffering and have been suffering from these non-democratic, I don't want to know what to call them, but non-democratic structures in all of these countries, and really put some kind of a plan together for the people of that land and help out the stronghold of the resistance of whatever kind that is trying and have been trying for some democracy and support them.
Said, thanks very much for your call. Professor, that's more or less what you've been saying, that you need a roadmap for each of the countries in the Middle East. But how should the U.S. apply pressure? As they did in your case, threaten to withhold aid?
Well, there is aid, there is trade, there is political support, there is selling arms. All kind of means are available to the United States and other big powers. And I don't want the United States alone to be the only actor in the region. There is Europe, and I call on Europe as well to get involved. And these governments in the Middle East need trade, need concessions, need free zones, need arms, need all kind of things. And that is where Western power can exert gentle pressure and can steadily increase that pressure until these countries show their sincere intentions or credible behavior that they are going to democratize. Let us take the example of Europe. The European Union, formerly the common market, it made democracy a condition for joining the Union. And that's still the case. So I would call for a similar strategy, that to give trade and aid concessions to countries in the southern Mediterranean, that should be conditional on democratization,
Barbara,
even if it's a gradual. Yes.
Barbara, can I bring you in here? Because interestingly, on 9/11, Saad was still in jail. You were in Manhattan. Did you at that moment think this ghastly event is really a wake-up call?
Well, I was a little bit too involved in the moment in trying to get through a message to my family in Egypt and to Saad that I was all right. I was with a friend that day whose daughter lived only a block north of the trade towers, and so we were very caught up in trying to be sure that her daughter was all right. But as I reflected, yes, in the coming days, I became very fearful that the wake-up call would not be a call to understand and to deepen our sense of the complexities of the issues in the Arab world, but would be what, in fact, I'm afraid it has been to some extent, an overreaction based on fear and uncertainty and lack of understanding, to set up the same kind of emergency courts and military mechanisms outside of the rule of law, which simply reinforce the problems in Egypt and elsewhere, because now they can turn to what has been always touted as the greatest democracy in the world, and they can say, look, when you're faced with a terrorist threat, you set aside the rule of law. You do exactly the same things that the Egyptian regime and others have done. And I fear this as an American who spent my adult life in the Arab world. I fear this for both sides of the Atlantic.
Thanks to you both. Nice to have you both. Have you, Professor Free, and back together, Professor Saad Eddin Ibrahim and Barbara Leatham Ibrahim. Saad's a professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo. He's in Atlanta receiving an award from the American Sociological Association. Barbara's the regional director for the Population Council in West Asia and North Africa. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.